Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us. Coming up in today's program, an extended Politics Ohio with Emily McCord. Her guest today, Congressman Mike Turner. We've also got Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac and a preview of tonight's Sunday Documentary Hour. Up first, joining me in studio this morning, Suzanne Albers. She is event coordinator with Free to Breathe. It's a run walk coming up on November 3rd to raise funds for the National Lung Cancer Partnership's Research, Education, and Awareness Programs. Suzanne, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Also, Kathy Fennig, lung cancer survivor, and she's going to share her story with us this morning. Kathy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jerry, for having us.
This is an annual event with the Lung Cancer Partnership. Let's talk about this year's event.
This year's event will be on Saturday morning, November 3rd. The actual run walk starts at 9 a.m. It is a 5K run or walk or a 1 mile run or walk. It is at a new location this year. We'll be in Kettering at the National Composite Center, which is at 2000 Composite Drive, right off of Wilmington Pike. And we hope to have over 700 participants this year, and our goal is to raise money and awareness for lung cancer research and raise the awareness of really who can get lung cancer and what the statistics are regarding treatment and diagnosis.
And do you feel awareness is growing?
I feel like it's growing, but it's nowhere where it needs to be. The funding for lung cancer, private and public, is very, very low compared to other cancers and other disease states. But our job and our goal is to continue to raise the awareness one person and $1 at a time so we can change the diagnosis and have these lung cancer patients live a long life.
Before we talk to Kathy, let's talk about some statistics that are associated with lung cancer.
Well, number one, you don't have to be a smoker to get lung cancer, although smoking is a risk factor. Really, if you have lungs, you can get lung cancer. The five-year survival rate for lung cancer is about 15%, and those rates have not changed in about 40 years. And I think that is the biggest statistic we need to change.
And can you tell us exactly what you mean by the five-year rate?
If a patient is diagnosed with lung cancer, almost regardless of stage, you have a 15% chance of being around in 5 years.
Lung cancer is the leading cause of cancer death in Ohio and the United States, claiming more lives of men and women than breast, colon, and prostate cancers combined.
Very surprising to hear that, yes, but that is the truth. And also, if you look at lung cancer as a woman's disease, lung cancer takes the lives of more women than breast cancer, ovarian, and uterine cancer. So it is very much a very prevalent disease and a very deadly disease that takes more lives than breast cancer, yes.
Survival rates, you said, are nowhere near where they need to be. Let's talk about how has medication and treatment progressed over the last, say, decade?
I think they're making a lot of inroads in the area of diagnosis and earlier diagnosis with recommended CT scans for patients who are at risk. There are a lot of new drugs out there on the market, but right now they're just not quite sure where to use them, how to use them, who to use them in. So I think they're gaining a lot of ground and gaining traction, but the actual statistics have not changed. And what we're trying to do with the Free to Breathe event is to make a change in this. And you can see where other diseases have received a lot of awareness and therefore a lot of funding, and the survival rates have increased. And that's really what we're trying to do, is to raise some money, to be quite honest, so we can get better diagnosis and better treatment and extend the lives of these lung cancer patients.
Also joining us again, Kathy Fennig, lung cancer survivor, and she's here to share her story. So, Kathy, where does your story begin?
Well, my story begins in December of 2010. A few months prior to December, I had a very dear cousin of mine who passed away from lung cancer. He never smoked a day in his life, but he was diagnosed at stage 4 lung cancer and died 2 months later. After his death, I started thinking, I thought, well, I was a former smoker. I used to smoke. And I thought, well, you know, if Oscar got lung cancer and he didn't smoke, I wonder if that kind of sets me up a little bit to have a higher chance of getting lung cancer because of my smoking history. So I called my physician office, thinking I'm proactive about my own health and requested a screening CT scan, knowing that really a CT scan is a better way of finding lung cancer at the earliest stage. Oftentimes it's missed on a chest x-ray. After speaking to the nurse, I requested the CT scan, and she said, well, you know, I don't think the physician is going to order a CT scan if you don't have symptoms. Do you have a symptom? And I said, no, I don't have any symptoms at all. She said, well, I'll check with them. She called me back a few days later and said, you know, he said you can have a chest x-ray. So, you know, thinking, well, at least I got the chest x-ray. I had the chest x-ray done. And several days later, the physician called back and said that they wanted a different angle, said that they didn't think they saw anything, but they just wanted to make sure and wanted to do a different angle. And at that point, I said, you know, I said, I really don't want the different angle. I want the CT scan. So he did say, you know, I think you're right. You probably should have that given your history. So I had the CT scan, and sure enough, there was a small 9-millimeter nodule in my upper right lobe and a 5-millimeter nodule in my middle lobe of my right lung. And the thought at that time, and still is, if you have nodules on your lungs, that you follow those with a repeat CT scan in 6 or 3 months. I opted for 3 months. And what they're looking for is to see if there's any growth. There are situations, many situations, especially in the state of Ohio, where people have nodules on their lungs and they're perfectly benign. And with mine, my second CT scan showed that the nodule grew 2 millimeters. And so the thought was then that it was large enough to biopsy. So I had a biopsy done. And the rest is history. It showed adenocarcinoma, which is actually considered non-smokers' lung cancer. So, you know, you even though I smoked, I can't say that, yeah, my smoking caused my lung cancer. You just don't know. There's all kinds of reasons why people get lung cancer. It can be radon exposure, exposure to diesel fuel. Sometimes there's just a genetic component there that people get lung cancer. So the message I would want to say, you know, send your way is that don't feel that you are exempt from getting lung cancer because you never smoked. That's just not the case. So I had a very good surgeon who removed my upper and middle lobe of my right lung. And after recovery from that, it was very, very frightening. And I kind of went through a period of depression, kind of self-blame too, you know, because you did smoke, you kind of feel like, gosh, what did I do to myself? You know, I gave myself cancer, and I looked at my grandchildren and I thought, well, I'm not going to see them grow up and they're going to say, where's grandma? And they're going to, my daughter's going to have to say, well, grandma smoked and she got lung cancer. But, you know, we don't know that, but that's the way I felt. So, you know, once I brushed myself off and gathered my thoughts, I thought, you know, we need to do something about these grim statistics. So I called the National Lung Cancer Partnership. The reason I chose the National Lung Cancer Partnership is because I found their information online very valuable. I'm a healthcare professional. I've been a nurse for 42 years. I've worked for the same organization for 42 years. When I got my diagnosis of lung cancer, I felt like I was all alone. I had to navigate this system, trying to figure out what my best treatment options were, and I didn't feel like I had any help at all, nothing like if I had had breast cancer. And I don't mean to take anything from people with breast cancer, but there's lots of help out there if you've got breast cancer. You have someone holding your hand through the whole process. Believe me, there was no one holding my hand getting through the lung cancer maze. It was frightening. And I did, on my own, find an oncologist that was willing to help me, even though we didn't know at that time if I would be even an oncology patient. But anyways, I got through that, and I really felt that I needed to volunteer. I needed to do something to help other people. So what I do now as a volunteer is I make sure that that written information gets out to patients that are newly diagnosed with lung cancer so that they aren't left navigating the system themselves and figuring out afterwards, did I do the right thing? Did I go to the right chest surgeon? Am I doing the right thing by not having chemotherapy or radiation? So, you know, those kind of questions you are faced with when you get a diagnosis like this. So
this event, Free to Breathe, as well as things like this interview, is to raise awareness, and you're telling your story. In the 3 months that you were waiting to check back, did you start doing research that early?
I went on the internet every night. In fact, there were times that my husband had to take the computer away from me because I would have periods of panic because I'd read these grim statistics. And I would say, oh my gosh, 5 years from now, I probably won't be here. And I haven't even had a chance to retire. And I thought, oh my gosh, I saved all this money for our retirement, and where is it going to get me? Absolutely nowhere. My husband and his new wife will be going to Hawaii on my dime. So I know that sounds crazy, but I did think of that. So I did get on the internet all the time, and it was frightening what I read.
Tell us about finding out about Free to Breathe. When did your involvement begin there?
After my surgery, I was back to work, and I came home for lunch one afternoon, and I saw Suzanne and on Channel 2 doing an interview about the Free to Breathe event, and it was about a week before the event, and I thought, whoa, my ears perked up, lung cancer awareness, whoa, boy, do we need that. I'm going to do that right away. I got my computer out right then and there. And I signed up to participate in the Free to Breathe event. And my daughter, her husband, her children, my husband, we all signed up for the event that year, and that was just last year. And I remember how touching it was that my daughter, who had just given birth to a baby 2 weeks before the event, bless her heart, she got out there and pushed that little baby in that crisp morning of November 5th, I think it was. And I thought, wow, you know what? That really showed to me that she had a lot of support for me.
Suzanne, I want to talk about the scope of Free to Breathe events. It's not happening just here in Ohio.
This is the fifth annual event in the Dayton area. There are a total of 42 events across the country. Some people are having yoga-thons. There are some motorcycle rides, some golf outings. So the Free to Breathe event is just not about running and walking. It can be whatever that organization in that area would like to have to raise money. We have raised over $3 million, and with those $3 million, we have given that directly to young professionals, researchers in the area of lung cancer to help with the earlier treatment and diagnosis of lung cancer.
Suzanne, Kathy, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jerry.
Thank you for having us.
And for more information on the Saturday, November 3rd event, you can find information at participate.freetobreathe.org. This is WISO Weekend. The weather conditions are certainly changing fast, and it's time to check in with the man who brings clarity to the living world around us, Bill Felker.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the third week of middle fall. It wasn't that long ago that all the workings of the world were great mysteries. Since people didn't know what kind of forces made the weather, they gave equal weight to a regular rain shower and a shower of frogs. Yes, there have been showers of frogs. Stories about amazing weather phenomena were popular not only because they were curious, but because people couldn't figure out at all why they were occurring. Some people, a lot of people, thought the unusual events were signs from heaven. When I was growing up, my grandfather would look at a blood-red full moon and say, "Someone's going to die tonight." It made sense to me at the time. It scared me. The color couldn't just be there for nothing. It had to mean something. These days, we have satellites and scientists to tell us everything we want to know. In fact, we depend on them so much we don't really pay much attention to what's going on around us. We accept their professional assertions because, after all, they're modern and they're on TV or the internet. We don't really understand how all those things work, of course. We just believe someone else understands. We take it on faith. Now I've given up worrying about the blood-red moon, and I accept, on faith, the explanation of the meteorologists who say that the color comes from gases or particles in the atmosphere which are such and such a way at such and such a time. Just like people used to accept the explanation given to them by the authorities of their own time and place. That this earthquake, or that tremendous clap of thunder, or that shower of fishes was really an act of God. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the fourth week of Middle Fall. In the meantime, watch for the moon to rise red at the end of the week. What will it mean this time?
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at wyso.org.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Emily McCord, and today I'm joined by Congressman Mike Turner. He represents Ohio's 3rd District, and he's seeking re-election for Ohio's newly formed 10th District. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Emily, thank you for focusing on this race. I appreciate that.
As I mentioned, this is a newly formed district. Some voters that may not know you may have not voted for you before. What's your message to them? Why do you deserve to be reelected?
Well, if you look at my record of both support for Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which has undertaken the largest growth since World War II, over $350 million worth of new construction to accept BRAC jobs that were awarded in the amount of about 2,500 jobs that has grown to 10,000 additional jobs at Wright-Patt. My work experience working as a team member, as the mayor of Dayton, the Schuster Center, the baseball stadium, Riverscape, people know that I'm about making things happen. And with the expanded district, I can tell you my parents are very excited to vote for me. They've been living in Beaver Creek for the past 25 years, Greene County residents, and they're very excited with the expanded district that they'll finally get to go to the polls and vote for their son.
And it is a new district. Now, all of Montgomery County, Greene County, and parts of Fayette County. Is there any concern that this is more – Montgomery County certainly leans Democrat, that there's a different level of support for Republican candidate than there used to be in the past?
Well, you know, I served as the mayor of the city of Dayton, so I have always worked in a bipartisan manner, and certainly – I look at this region as a very thoughtful region that votes and elects based on the person. And I think, when you look at my record, when you look at what I've accomplished for the community, hopefully I will have the support of the people in the 10th District.
I want to talk about sequestration, because certainly that could have implications for Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in the Miami Valley. Sequestration was set into motion with the debt ceiling talks, and it's these across-the-board cuts that will happen unless a budget deal is reached, and it could mean something like $500 billion in additional cuts for the defense industry. President Obama, in the last debate, said that sequestration wasn't going to happen. Do you agree with that?
Well, I'm very concerned about the president's position. As you know, I voted against raising the debt limit, one, because I believe that we were not taking seriously the issue of getting control of the out-of-control spending in Washington. Secondly, of the threats of sequestration, that we would be gambling with our national security, that these automatic, as you described, cross-the-board cuts that would occur in January would be devastating not only to our national security, but also to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. The president is on record as saying that he would veto any bill to repeal sequestration. And in fact, when the super committee was put together in an attempt to avert the sequestration, the president withdrew from any discussion or negotiations with them. He has not put on the table any plan that would offset these cuts. The House has passed a bill that would offset the cuts. The Senate has not passed one, nor have they even debated one. So with the president saying they're not going to happen, I think the president needs to show the American public, well, how with him having such a strong position that he would veto any effort to offset them, does he intend to avert these?
One of the main points of contention in Congress is the idea of these Bush-era tax cuts. Would there be any compromise on your end in terms of letting any part of the Bush-era tax cuts expire in order to get a budget deal passed?
Well, you know, one thing I like to point out is that they keep referring to these as the Bush-era tax cuts, but in fact, the tax cuts that are currently in place are Obama-era tax cuts because Obama actually supported and asked Congress to extend them, and they were extended. So these are actually the Obama-era tax cuts of the Bush tax cut plan. The president has said that he wants to selectively have some of them expire, and quite frankly, I think what he has picked would be devastating to the economy. I mean, if you actually go and raise taxes on small businesses across the country at a time when we're trying to create jobs and when we're struggling economically, you will cost the economy jobs. When the government takes money out of the system, our economic system has less money within which to spend for capital, for job creation, and the government never does as good enough job in what it does with it as with what private sector does. So I think, with the anemic economic growth that we have, it is absolutely a mistake to raise taxes. Now, I do believe that the president needs to come to the table and look at whole-scale budgetary and tax reform. And when we do that, of course, obviously, then we have to look at every aspect of both our budgeting and our taxes, and that puts on the table then hopefully getting us to a path of ending these $1 trillion deficits.
So in terms of the tax cuts, you don't want to support any reduction?
They should not retire, right. They should not be repealed.
What about other forms of compromise? Can you give me an example of something that you would be willing to compromise on in order to get a budget deal passed?
Sure. Well, the proposal that we have has 50% of all the cuts falling against defense, which is only 17% of the budget. I mean, I think that what we need is a whole-scale review of all of the budgetary processes of the federal government. You know, when I was mayor for the city of Dayton, I inherited a city that had not balanced its budget for 5 years, and we immediately had to balance the budget. We did so by doing a whole-scale review. We even looked for savings in the police and fire department, even though at the same time we were expanding services in the police and the fire department. Similarly, we need to do that in the federal budget. Looking to savings in defense can allow us to apply those savings still to national security without cutting national security. But I think what's real important about the president's deal that I think people are rejecting is that the president brought forth a budget in January that had increased taxes and increased spending. Now, I've gone all across Southwest Ohio, and I've asked people two questions. How many people in the room would be willing to pay increased taxes to actually pay down the national debt, recognizing that it's an existential threat to our country? We're passing this off to our kids and our grandkids. It's a stone dragging our economy. And I'll get half the room, two-thirds of the room, to raise their hand saying that they would make that sacrifice to actually pay down the national debt. And then I'll ask them the second question. How many of you are willing to pay increased taxes for increased spending? Not one person raises their hand. And that was the president's budget. That's why when it went to the House floor, it received no votes. When it went to the Senate floor, it received no votes. So the president's plan is not workable. And it certainly is not a beginning point for a dialogue where there can be compromise.
So you're talking about savings in the defense industry. Would you be willing to see any cuts additionally to the defense industry in order to reach a deal?
Well, already the president has pushed forward $500 billion worth of cuts to the defense industry and to cross the national security line. Those cuts are still falling in place. They're over a 10-year period. We're seeing the effects. I do believe that the Department of Defense has a plan that they think is workable to sustain those initial cuts. What we have now, though, are additional cuts that are proposed, where even Secretary Panetta, former Secretary Gates, both say these cuts would be devastating. We cannot allow these cuts to go forward without risking our national security. Remember, the world is not getting to be a safer place. We're not talking about cutting future systems. We're not about cutting excessive spending at this point. At this point, we would have to park aircraft carriers. Planes would have to be parked. There are pilots that would not receive their flight training hours. This really would be devastating.
So no, in terms of any other further defense cuts, you would not support that?
I think the additional, the first $500 billion cut that went into the national defense is probably the full extent that they would be able to sustain.
Let's talk about Delphi for a moment. This is an issue that you have been talking about a lot. Delphi, when it went bankrupt, non-union employees lost anywhere 30 to 70% of their pensions while their union counterparts retained their pensions. Why is this an issue that is so important to you?
Well, it's a complete injustice. I mean, we have, when the bankruptcy went through, the federal government, by stepping in and acquiring General Motors and having the auto task force that was funding the acquisition of General Motors, and having the PBGC, the arm that's supposed to guarantee pensions of those who are in retirement, be subservient to the Treasury Department, and then also the UAW at the table with this administration putting together a deal. You have the Treasury Department on all sides of a deal where in our judicial system. For a bankruptcy to work, the parties all come in independent, and then compromise and solutions are worked out with the judge weighing the interests of all the parties. What happened is all the parties became Tim Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, except for the Delphi salary retirees, who then had their pensions reduced. It's wrong. I believe it's illegal. The lawsuit that is pending by the Delphi salary retirees, I think, has a great chance of pointing out the impropriety that occurred here. At the same time that the administration did this, again, with taxpayers' dollars, they also then refused to share any of the documents or information or the basis by which they picked winners and losers. You know, when all these employees, former employees, retirees of Delphi, you know, present themselves in the bankruptcy case, they all, by contract, have rights to their pensions. And until the administration came in and said, we're going to deal with each of these parties differently, they all stood in the same shoes. They all stood equal. You know, that's not how our country works. We don't have people based upon their designation or relationship with the administration be treated differently in the outcome of a bankruptcy court.
We spoke to your opponent, Sharon Neuhart, last week on the program Politics Ohio, and she was saying that your focus is on the wrong thing, that your focus should be on restoring the pensions to the workers. And she points to legislation from Sherrod Brown, U.S. Senator Sherrod Brown, that would do that. What's your response to that?
Well, that is our focus, is restoring the pensions. And certainly that's why the Delphi Star retirees are working with us so diligently, because one, you know, their litigation is proceeding with our full endorsement. The congressional investigations are all about restoring the pensions. The legislation that Senator Brown put forward, I believe, is a certainly cast within the political environment of the throes of the last month of a political campaign. And if it was law today, not $1 would go to one pension of the Delphi salary retirees. That's not a solution that works. I mean, if his legislation would fund the Delphi salary retirees' pensions today, you'd have the whole group of them heralding it and marching to Washington demanding that the bill be passed. It would not put today $1 in their pensions. And of course, he doesn't have any support for the administration for this legislation either.
Is there an alternative piece of legislation that you would propose that would restore the pensions to these workers?
Well, what we have supported, and what I think is probably the best solution, is that the Delphi salary retirees themselves have a proposal as to how their pensions are restored. We are continuing to support that. We believe that with the oversight review of Congress, with the litigation that is ongoing, that both the administration and PBGC, upon reviewing the proposal, will see that the pension funds were sufficient, and that the discrimination of these pensioners was improper, and that therefore the pensions should be restored.
I've been speaking with Congressman Mike Turner. He's representing Ohio's 3rd District and running for re-election for Ohio's 10th District. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
You can hear both of our interviews with Congressman Turner and his opponent, Sharon Neuhart, on our website, wyso.org.
That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening to member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, a broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. Coming up next, the Book Nook, but here's a look at tonight's Sunday Documentary Hour with Sarah Buckingham.
Tonight at 6 p.m., it's The Devil You Know, a collection of election horror stories from PRX and The Truth. The Truth is a podcast that makes movies for your ears. The stories are entirely fictional, created with rich sound and professional acting from Peabody Award-winning producers Jonathan Mitchell and Carrie Hillman. Tonight's special includes stories about a canvasser who gets the donations she needs, but it costs her, and a story that imagines how Edgar Allan Poe really died. And we'll hear about Mike Coleman, an independent candidate running for Congress, who's finally getting some attention from a serial killer. That's coming up tonight at 6 p.m. on an election-themed Halloween special from The Truth. And of course, tune in for WTF at 11 p.m. This week's guest is comedian Carl LeBeau, who was the opening act and best friend of the late Sam Kinison. That's tonight on the Sunday Documentary Hour.
This week on American Roots, celebrate the spirit world of Louisiana at this time of All Saints and Souls with a graveside visit to Voodoo Queen Marie Laveau. We'll also hear from South Louisiana traiteurs, traditional healers, and talk with New Orleans' own R&B Buddha, Fats Domino. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX. Oh, you must put Buddha on me.
This afternoon at 2 on WISO.